Al-Quds, Al-Yawm, and Al-Hayat, Al-Jadida daily said in their main front page story that the Israeli troops shot and killed Mahmoud Saadi, a high school student, during an assault into the northern West Bank city of Jenin and injured four others. Al-Yawm said in another story that many Palestinians were injured in clashes with Israeli regime troops in Al-Khalil and Togu in the south of the West Bank. Al-Quds said injuries, demolitions and settlers attacked Palestinians in the West Bank. Al-Hayat Al-Jadida said the German prosecution rejected the complaint against President Mahmoud Abbas, explaining that his detention was to highlight the crimes of Israeli regime army and the injustice of his people. It said President Abbas met with world leaders during his presence in Qatar for the opening of World Cup ceremonies. It also said the Pope Francis expressed sorrow for the death in fire in the Gaza Strip. Al-Yawm quoted Foreign Minister Riyaz Malhi criticizing a deal between European Union and the Zionist regime on exchanging data that includes the Palestinians in the occupied territories, describing it as an unprecedented scandal and a blatant violation of international law. Al-Quds Daily said the Palestinian government decided to establish a cybersecurity unit. It quoted Minister of Local Government Majdi Salhi saying that the Zionist regime has been rejecting for the past 9 years plans to expand West Bank towns. The dailies also highlighted the latest in the news about the formation of the Israeli regime cabinet and the results of the World Cup matches. Wafa News Agency also reported the Israeli regime occupation forces rounded up at least 24 Palestinians in early morning and last night raids at their homes in the occupied territories, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, PPS. It said six Palestinians were rounded up at their homes in Silwan neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds and two others, a father and his son, detained in town of Anata, east of Al-Quds. Five others were detained in the Ramallah district, including two siblings from Deir Abu Mash'al, west of Ramallah, and three former prisoners from Silwat and Burga, east of Ramallah. In Nablus, Israeli regime troops detained a 16-year-old boy after raiding his home in Balata refugee camp. Three were detained in each of Jenin, in north of the West Bank, and Beit Lahm, in south of the West Bank. The others rounded up recently, war from Tul Karm and Al-Khalil. Economic divide.
The ASEAN summit has taken place and the U.S. presented a strategic partnership agreement to those countries. Now, will it be enough to sway those countries into its sphere, or is it going to face a resounding defeat when it comes to Chinese influence and trade? Hi, I'm Kabat Ahwi. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, some of the highlights. When it comes to U.S.-ASEAN relations, we will take a look at that. Years of diplomatic freeze, this came from the U.S. side. Well, the former U.S. President Donald Trump's lackluster approach was one of the reasons, many dubious of U.S.'s long-term commitments to that region. So we have to wait and see, later on in the program, how that pans out. Then we have the U.S. initiative, in which it was called by the current U.S. President Joe Biden, the Strategic Partnership. Well, it's called for a free and open Indo-Pacific to counter China. But will it work with that aim in mind? And finally, the U.S. goal is confronting China. We ask ASEAN countries whether that's going to work, or are they going to stiff arm China? and live with potential consequences. The stiff competition, RCEP.
The U.S. and Chinese presidents have ended a landmark meeting in Indonesia's Bali. During the meeting, Joe Biden and Xi Jinping reiterated the necessity of handling their relations in a peaceful and proper manner. Biden said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming a conflict. For his part, Xi said that he is looking forward to working with Biden to bring Beijing-Washington ties back on the right track. Before the meeting, Biden traveled to Cambodia to underscore the U.S. partnership with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, countries. One of Biden's primary aims during that trip was to counter China's growing influence in that region. Biden announced the U.S.-ASEAN Comprehensive Strategic Partnership and noted a budget request for $850 million in assistance for Southeast Asia. Biden also pointed to a new U.S.-ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, which is aimed at strengthening the U.S. foothold in that region for further economic integration.
Through our new U.S.-ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, we're going to work together to develop an integrated electric vehicle ecosystem in Southeast Asia, enabling the region to pursue clean energy economic development and ambitious emissions reductions targets.
It is no secret that China and the U.S., as two superpowers, are vying for influence in the region. The two countries are locked in a number of disputes, which includes trade, Taiwan, hegemony over the South China Sea.
Online content on this, as posted by viewers, is varied, but it wants to find out whether there's a U.S. commitment. That's what we found out when it came to the social media post. This is our first post, for example, where it said, ASEAN is at the heart of my administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Thank you for 45 years of partnership and for all that we can accomplish together. Next one, the U.S. on Saturday upgraded its ties with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, vowing to deliver more aid as President Joe Biden steps up efforts to counter China's growing influence in the regional bloc. Now, we dug a little bit further and looked at this. U.S. doubles down on ASEAN aid to counter China, making his first trip to Southeast Asia as president. Biden said that the two sides will tackle the biggest issues of our time, from global warming to significant threats to the rule-based order, along with threats to the rule of law. Next, this tweet seeking to counter China. Biden and hosts ASEAN leaders had a post within a post in which we found interesting, and it was titled, Seeking to Counter China, Biden Hosts ASEAN Leaders. Now, this happened back in May 2022. Looking deeper into the post, it said, with the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, and the U.S. not part of the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, of which China is a part of, Washington ceded ground to Beijing in the ASEAN region, especially as far as economics is concerned. Okay, so those were some of the posts there. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Joining us for the first segment of the Q&A is Kim Do-ju. He's a political commentator at the Pangol Institution. Kim Do-ju, welcome to Economic Divide. We are looking at President Joe Biden, where he's come out saying that the relationship between the U.S. and ASEAN countries is at the heart of the U.S. administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Of course, this comes really after a diplomatic freeze, especially from the U.S., former U.S. President Donald Trump, which didn't have a real warm approach to the region as a whole. Biden now has to step up ties. Do you think that he's going to be able to do that, especially with the intention of trying to counter China's growing influence? Will he be successful?
If the goal is to counter China, I'm sure it is doomed. He will not succeed in that direction. The reason is simple. If you look at the relationship between ASEAN countries and China, for example, and this year, despite this pandemic linking over the two sides and other kinds of challenges, If you look at the trade relationship between the two sides, it still scored double-digit growth in the last 10 months of this year. And it's expected to, you know, the total volume of the two sides could reach as high as $1 trillion this year or early next year. This is a strong signal, you know, showing to the world that how close China and ASEAN are. Look, the U.S. has a presence mostly, and unfortunately, is a military presence, you know, military bases in Japan, South Korea, in the Philippines, or Thailand. You know, for the U.S., the purpose is to maintain its dominance in this region as well as around the world. For China, it's really about, you know, co-development, a win-win cooperation.
Okay, that's thoughts of Kendra Du there. Richard Black joins us now. He's from the Schiller Institute, and he's a UN representative. Richard Black, welcome to our program. In terms of countering China, U.S. President Joe Biden has said that he wants to build what he has termed as the U.S.-ASEAN Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, in which he said it's going to be an Indo-Pacific region that's free and open, stable and prosperous, resilient and secure. But China and the regional countries are part of the RCEP. That's a huge trade bloc composed of 15 countries. How can the U.S. compete with that? And what should the regional countries be interested in when it comes to U.S. initiatives?
Well, this is a very good question. Look, China has just built, in conjunction with the government of Laos, Laos's first super high-speed railroad. This is part of a plan for all of Southeast Asia called the Pan-Asian Railroad Network. At the G20 summit in Indonesia, prepared a Chinese-designed high-speed rail line connecting the great cities of Bandung and Jakarta. It's now 90% complete. So if the U.S. wanted to succeed in competing, then it would follow China's policy and do likewise. Or to put it another way, how many kilometers of high-speed rail are there in Laos, and how many in the United States? Well, in Laos, because of China's policy, there are 1,400 kilometers of high-speed rail. How many kilometers in the USA? Zero. So the United States could compete, but they would have to emulate China's policy of build, 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 and transfer advanced technology to the former colonial, the underdeveloped, the looted sector.
It's time now from the InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at news from around the world. Well, our first item talks about something that's very important, deemed important by economic divide, and that's a multipolar world. Now, there's an effort being put forward on that front where China is saying that it wants to help build a multipolar world. Wang Yi told his Russian colleague or counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, that Beijing will work with Moscow in order to achieve that. Now, China is ready to work with Russia and also other like-minded countries in order to promote the development of a multipolar world, firmly to support the process of democracy and when it comes to international relations, and to defend the international system that's based on the UN. So that is something, obviously, that's very important when it comes to the, some call it the New World Order, but revised. Next up, another huge layoff from a big conglomerate by the name of Amazon, which I'm sure you heard of. Massive layoffs have been actually executed, where it's going to sack thousands of workers. The layoffs reportedly coming, perhaps by the time you watch this program, they're going to be happening. U.S. Giant Amazon may fire up to 10,000 employees. That's the projected number. Now, the news of potential job cuts comes days after Facebook parent Meta and also Twitter each carried out massive layoffs, sending clear signals that the tech sector is preparing for an inevitable recession. Next up, the status of the U.S. credit is under question here when it comes to consumers. You have some retail store credit cards that at this point are now carrying APRs of more than 30%. Now, the rate hikes comes by the Federal Reserve, in which major retail credit cards, you may have heard of some like Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Shell, or ExxonMobil and Wayfair. where they recently bumped up their maximum APRs to more than 30%. Now, what does that mean? Well, this means that high inflation is forcing American consumers to rack up more debt, and that's not good news because obviously they have to pay that amount, the principal amount, plus the interest that is accrued on that. Next up, we go to Australia. The topic we chose was slavery, in which there was a law that is not working. A coalition of rights groups have called on the government to strengthen anti-slavery legislation. Australia's businesses are failing to address forced labor risk. And that's an important topic when it comes to their supply chains. Now, this comes 4 years after the introduction of slavery laws, in which two out of three companies is not following that. Those were the topics we picked for our InfoNews section. Please do send us any ideas from your part of the world. We would really appreciate it. Contact information is on your screens.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The end-up section is upon us. To get an understanding of this rivalry between China and the U.S., which the IMF has said risks splintering the global economy, we need to take a look at the trade activity between China, the U.S., and ASEAN countries. Now, back in the year 2020, U.S. goods and service trade with ASEAN totaled $362.2 billion. Exports came in at $111.9 billion, imports $250.3 billion, and the U.S. goods and services trade deficit with ASEAN was $138.4 billion. Now, moving on to the year 2021, the trade volume of the goods between China and ASEAN in this case was $878.2 billion. It reached a year-on-year increase of 28.1%. Among them, China's exports came in at $483.69 billion. That's 26.1% increase year-on-year. And then imports were $394.51 billion, an increase of 30.8%. ASEAN actually became China's largest trading partner, which was for the second consecutive year. Vietnam, Malaysia, and Thailand are China's top three trading partners in ASEAN. Now, by comparison, total trade for the U.S. and ASEAN countries was, well, $362.2 billion, in which China's trade with ASEAN countries was $878.2 billion. Now, if you take a look at this chart here, not chart really, but you can see the difference there, how much more it is. It's almost three times that amount. Now, while the U.S. is trying to build a U.S.-ASEAN strategic partnership, which it describes as a free and open Indo-Pacific, in order to counter China, it's going to have a hard time doing that because of the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which includes 15 East Asian and Pacific nations. It encompasses 30% of the world's GDP. In terms of the trade, comes in at $2.3 trillion among its members. 90% of tariffs on goods, that's eliminated within the bloc. So how can the U.S. even begin to compete with that, let alone try to woo the ASEAN members into joining its partnership agreement? I mean, the figures speak for themselves. Okay, let's have our guests rejoin us and get a breakdown on this. We have Kin Do Ju, political commentator at the Pangol Institution, who rejoins us. Kin Do Ju, welcome back to Economic Divide, U.S. goals in the South China Sea to confront China or to slow down China as they'd like to, which has not ruled out military confrontation, as I'm sure you're well aware of, things like Taiwan, for example. How can regional countries even entertain the thought of war when it comes to this rivalry between the U.S. and China, especially in their own backyard?
Well, obviously, regional countries are perfectly clear of the U.S. strategy to contain China or to have a new Cold War, and they are not warming up to such an idea because they are not for a divided world or divided region. They are for more integration and more investment and trade, more integration in this region, because that's their priorities.
Richard Black comes in now in order to have his take on this. He's from the Schiller Institute and a UN representative. Richard Black, welcome back. U.S. goals when it comes to China, it is obvious that they not only see China as a rival, they want to contain China, and they want China to be slowed down when it comes to, obviously, things like its economic prowess. At the same time, we're looking at a U.S. that has somewhat of a militaristic tone when it comes to China. Are they going to be able to do that? And then comes the countries. Will the U.S. be able to rally those countries behind it?
Well, again, let's refer to the excellent leaders of the ASEAN. The very courageous leader of Cambodia, Hun Sen, made a very strong statement at the ASEAN this week again, and I'll quote, let's look at what the leaders of Asia themselves are saying. He said, a spirit of togetherness in upholding open and inclusive multilateralism, pragmatism, and mutual respect in addressing the existential and strategic challenges we all face. That's the key, inclusive multilateralism. So what's going on? Let's set this in context. There's a new international monetary and trade system being currently formed based on the idea of transferring advanced energy-intense technology to the global south, the former colonial sector. Russia and China are playing the leading role in this. It involves the SCO, ASEAN, the BRICS. So what we're calling for is a very loud chorus internationally of the non-aligned sector, as it has always been called, a renewed vigor coming from the renowned the non-aligned sector, calling for an end for this global NATO drive for nuclear war. And of course, we feel that Iran could play a very leading role in such an international chorus. The big issue is whether or not there's going to be a nuclear war triggered by global NATO.
The South China Sea is a major trade route. China is a dominant power there. An estimated $3.4 trillion worth of international shipping trade passes through that area each year. China has gained effective control of the route, which has economic, strategic, and political importance. China and the regional countries are also part of the RCEP, which stands for the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. RCEP is a free trade agreement among the Asia-Pacific nations. The 15 member countries account for about 30% of the world's population and 30% of global GDP. China is a major player in that economic pact.
The world now is facing unprecedented situation. It's important that in the recovery of together, we are focusing on the collaboration aspect. The theme on the B20 is advancing innovation, inclusion, and collaboration. So I think this is really three areas that's very important where the China can play a role.
U.S. goals in the South China Sea is to ultimately confront, then slow down China, which it has not ruled out military confrontations on issues like Taiwan. China also enjoys the status of a comprehensive strategic partner with ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. In 2021, the trade balance between ASEAN members and China came to $668.9 billion, compared to U.S.'s $364.4 billion. Beijing investments in that region were $13.5 billion, while the U.S. invested $40 billion there.
When it comes to the ASEAN countries, the US and China are vying for influence. The question is, who is in the lead? We argue that there isn't even a competition, since China has beaten US by far. First, the trade volume between China and the Association of Southeast Asian nations has skyrocketed 85 times over the past three decades. Over the past 30 years, the business communities of China and ASEAN have jointly promoted the China-ASEAN Free Trade Area, participated in the Belt and Road Initiative, and supported the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership negotiations, making important contributions to the continuous development of China-ASEAN economic and trade cooperation. Asian countries have also been working toward financial integration for many years, and a new joint statement made by China, Japan and South Korea, and ASEAN countries deepened the trend. The Chiang Mai Initiative, multilateralization, one of the arrangements that fosters financial integration among Asian countries. It is a multilateral currency swap arrangement between ASEAN plus three members. This addresses short-term liquidity difficulties in the region. It also aims to create a regional foreign exchange reserve in a bid to tackle the imbalance in international payments and short-term liquidity shortage. Participants agreed on a $240 billion fund, among which ASEAN countries will contribute 20%, while Japan and China will each put in 32% and South Korea will contribute the rest. When it comes to the ties between ASEAN countries and Chinese President Xi Jinping, the Chinese president in November 2021 called for a new round of what he called upgrades in the free trade area between China and the ASEAN. And what about the U.S.? History has tainted its relationship with ASEAN and the region as a whole. Let's dial back to the previous U.S. administration led by former U.S. President Donald Trump. During the 35th summit in 2019, it was reported that the United States lost ground in its struggle with China for the hearts and minds of Southeast Asia. It contributed this to the decline in U.S. soft power in the region, which had accelerated. It also laid blame on U.S. withdrawal from Trans-Pacific Partnership, along with former U.S. President Donald Trump's America First policy. The America First policy, which neglects the region's strategic interests while economically punishing and alienating potential supporters, is something the current president, Joe Biden, is striving to correct. So, you see, the U.S. has a lot of catching up to do, and given its confrontational approach to China, which is militaristic in nature, it doesn't look that it will stand a chance to pull countries in this region into its sphere. That does it for this edition of the program.
Don't doubt it. The U.S. is going to push its agenda in the South Asian region, with the number one goal being countering China. This will be void of what the U.S. has called a healthy competition that the U.S. says it is open to. The reason is that the U.S. cannot see itself cede its number one status in the world as a superpower. Will the U.S. prevail, or will China? Well, if you ask ASEAN countries, or Latin American countries, or countries in West Asia, or countries in Africa, they're going to say China. Then what's left? That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Ikobitawe, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests. With the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Yes, pass the ball! I hope Iran wins. Hey, we scored a goal! Thank you, guys!
ایران دو ورز صفر. ما باید برمیگشتیم به اینجا و برگشتیم. گل دوم به نام رامین
Hello. رزاد. I'm watching the game. Did you see the goal? Iran was great. What's up?
نخواهند کرد.
Oh, rafting? Where? In Haraz River? On Thursday? Okay, good idea. Bye-bye. Iran has unique characteristics due to its geographical location. Two mountain ranges, namely Zagros in the west and Alborz in the north, have created permanent large rivers on the Iranian plateau. The Alborz mountain range in the south of the Caspian Sea, with Damavand Peak, has created the northern rivers of Iran, such as Haraz and Chalus, which are great places for water sports as well as rafting. The Zagros mountain range extends from northwest to southern Iran. This mountain range is home to the oldest Iranian ethnicities. It creates the most beautiful natural scenery and has also gifted the largest rivers to the people. Due to these features, Iran is one of the best countries for rafting. If you are looking for adventures during your trip to Iran, rafting in Iran is one of the best available options. In addition to all the tourist activities, rafting in Iran gives you the opportunity to have a real thrill. It is one of the most popular water sports in Iran. The months of April, May, and June are considered the best times to participate in rafting in Iran. Well, I am now beside Harrah's River. It's very interesting that this river stretches from Damavand Peak to the Caspian Sea. It's a very long river. So here we are for rafting. Rafting is a highly dynamic activity that is always unique. When people hear about rafting, they mostly imagine powerful rapids, dangerous environment, and adrenaline rush. Well, let me get prepared for the job. This sport has a special outfit.
Hey guys, listen carefully. There are some points about this sport which you have to take into consideration. Follow the rules during the journey. No pause on the way, just left or right, as I say. Whitewater rafting can be a dangerous sport, especially if basic safety precautions are not observed, so be very careful.
In case we fell down in the water, we have life jackets, so I feel confident and have no fear.
No question? So zip up your life jacket and sit down in your rafting boat. Ready? 1, 2, 3, go!
Try this sport once in your life, especially in Iranian Whitewater River.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The United States also played an obvious role in the recent riots that took place in our country in the past few weeks. This is their plan. This is their intention. However, the Iranian nation punched them in the mouth, and it will continue to punch them in the mouth after this. The ones we are really concerned about are those who devised these schemes and entered the scene of action with intention, plans, and knowledge. They were connected to foreign agencies. They committed a crime. The incident that happened in Shah Cheragh Shrine in Shiraz was a great crime. What did these boys in the second grade or the sixth grade or the tenth grade do to deserve this? The poor six-year-old boy who lost his father, his mother, and his brother in the criminal act, why did they weigh him down with so much grief? Why? How is this child going to bear this immense amount of unbearable grief? These are crimes. They are great crimes.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The young, pious, and religious students, our dear Arman, who was martyred while being tortured, and his lifeless body was abandoned on the streets of Tehran. What did he do to deserve this? Are these minor things? Who are these people? We need to think about it. Who are the people doing this? They are not our children. They are not our youth. Who are they? Who is giving them orders? Why haven't the so-called supporters of human rights condemned them? Why have they not condemned the Shiraz incident? Why do they repeat a false claim thousands of times on their platforms on the internet, yet ban the name of Arsham, one of the child victims of the terrorist attack? Why? Are these so-called supporters real supporters of human rights? That is what they are like. We need to recognize these. We need to recognize them. Of course, we will not let them get away with this. The Islamic Republic will definitely make these criminals pay.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Britain's Supreme Court on Wednesday, 23rd of November, rejected a bid by the devolved Scottish Government in Edinburgh to hold a new referendum on Scottish independence without the consent of London. We'll take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. France 24, France 24, has covered this story and gives us more details. Britain's highest court on Wednesday, 23rd of November, rejected a bid by the devolved Scottish Government in Edinburgh to hold a new referendum on independence without London's consent. The unanimous ruling by the Supreme Court torpedoed the Scottish Nationalist Government's push to hold a second referendum next year. The Scottish National Party, the SNP, had said that in that event it would turn the next general election into a de facto vote on splitting from the rest of the United Kingdom, threatening constitutional chaos. Scotland's First Minister and SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon said she respected the ruling but was disappointed. "If Scotland cannot choose our own future without Westminster's consent, the idea of the United Kingdom as a voluntary partnership was exposed as a myth," Nicola Sturgeon tweeted. Sturgeon tweeted, "While disappointed by it, I respect the ruling of the UK Supreme Court. It doesn't make law, only interprets it. A law that doesn't allow Scotland to choose our own future without Westminster consent exposes as myth any notion of the UK as a voluntary partnership and makes the case for independence." The Supreme Court's Scottish President, Robert Reid, said the power to call a referendum was reserved to the UK Parliament under Scotland's devolution settlement. Therefore, the Scottish Parliament does not have the power to legislate for a referendum on Scottish independence, Robert Reid said. Nicola Sturgeon's SNP-led government in Edinburgh wanted to hold a vote in October of next year on the question, should Scotland be an independent country? The British government, which oversees constitutional affairs for the whole country, has repeatedly refused to give Edinburgh the power to hold a second referendum. It considers that the last one, in 2014, when 55% of Scots rejected independence, settled the question for at least a generation. But Nicola Sturgeon and her party say there is now an indisputable mandate for another independence referendum, particularly in the light of Britain's departure from the European Union. Most voters in Scotland opposed Brexit. Scotland's last parliamentary election returned a majority of pro-independence lawmakers for the first time. At a hearing in the UK Supreme Court last month, lawyers for the government in London argued that the Scottish government could not decide to hold a referendum on its own. Permission had to be granted because the constitutional makeup of the four nations of the United Kingdom was a reserved matter for the government in London. Lawyers for the Scottish government wanted a ruling on the rights of the devolved parliament in Edinburgh if London continued to block an independence referendum. Lord Advocate Dorothy Bain, Scotland's top law officer, said Scottish independence was a live and significant issue in Scottish politics. The Scottish Government was seeking to create its own legal framework for another referendum, arguing that the right to self-determination is a fundamental and inalienable right. But the UK Supreme Court rejected international comparisons raised by the Scottish Nationalist Party SNP, which had likened Scotland to Quebec in Canada or to Kosovo. Reid said international law on self-determination only applied to former colonies, or where a people is oppressed by military occupation, or when a defined group is denied its political and civil rights. None of that applies to Scotland, the UK Supreme Court president said. Robert Reid also rejected the SNP's argument that a referendum would only be advisory and not legally binding. Any such vote would carry practical political consequences regardless of its legal status, the judge ruled. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Scottish Government cannot hold a second referendum on independence without approval from the British Parliament. The United Kingdom's top court ruled on Wednesday, 23rd of November, dealing a blow to nationalists' hopes of holding a vote next year. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the pro-independence Scottish National Party, the SNP, had announced earlier this year she intended to hold an advisory vote on secession next October, but that it had to be lawful and internationally recognised. After the UK Supreme Court ruled she could not do so without the approval of the United Kingdom Parliament, she repeated her vow to campaign in the next UK-wide election, expected to be held in 2024, solely on a platform of whether Scotland should be independent, making it a de facto referendum. We must and we will find another democratic, lawful and constitutional means by which the Scottish people can express their will. In my view, that can only be an election, Nicola Sturgeon told reporters. She added, as of today, democracy is what is at stake. It is now about whether or not we even have the basic democratic right to choose our own future, she said. In a referendum in 2014, the people of Scotland rejected ending the more than 300-year-old union with England by 55% to 45%. But nationalists argued that the vote for Brexit just 2 years later, which the majority of Scottish voters opposed, changed everything. However, the British government in London has repeatedly said it would not grant permission for another referendum, saying it should be a once-in-a-generation event. In a unanimous verdict of five judges, the Supreme Court ruled the Scottish government could not pass legislation paving the way for an advisory second referendum without the approval of Britain's Parliament. We respect the clear and definitive ruling of the Supreme Court, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said. Rishi Sunak added, I think that the people of Scotland want us to be working on fixing the major challenges that we collectively face, whether that's the economy, supporting the National Health Service, or indeed supporting Ukraine. Now is the time for politicians to work together.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
world with reporters.
Tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following US-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the US. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This imported government was brought to a US conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime, and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. Lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly.